Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
My name is Kathy Langer. I'm the lead buyer for the Tattered Cover, and I'm so pleased to welcome you all here tonight. Thank you all for coming, and thank you all for supporting independent bookstores. We really appreciate that very much. And this is really an exciting event tonight. We're just happy to see you all and happy to have our author here tonight. I had the great privilege of first meeting Kent Harif on the eve of the publication of Plain Song in 1999. Although Plain Song was his third novel, Following the Tie That Binds and Where You Once Belonged, it was the launch of Plain Song that brought Kent national attention and acclaim. Plain Song, set in the fictitious town of Holt on the plains of eastern Colorado, introduced us to an unforgettable cast of characters. Verlin Klinkenborg, reviewing it for the New York Times, called it a novel so foursquare, so delicate and lovely, that it has the power to exalt the reader. It won the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Award and the Maria Thomas Award in Fiction and was a finalist for the National Book Award. Eventide followed in 2004, also set in Holt, also brilliant and a critical and commercial success. Plain Song and Eventide were both adapted into plays, premiering at the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. In the hiatus between the publication of his novels, Kent collaborated with celebrated photographer Peter Brown on West of Last Chance, providing exquisite short prose pieces to accompany Brown's photographs depicting the beautiful and often brutal and harsh landscape of the West, one that his readers know well from his novels. With Benediction, we are back in Holt, Colorado, with a new cast of characters, all of whom are deeply human and complex, written with astonishing love and respect for the human condition and its mysteries. When I finished reading Benediction, I was quite literally stunned by its power. I was at a loss for words then and remain in awe. Reviewers, of course, are never at a loss for words. And I'll share a few of their comments. Harif is a master of what one of his characters called the precious ordinary. And another says, his sentences have the elegance of Hemingway's early work. His finest tuned tale yet, and so very true, we've waited a long time for an invitation back to Holt. Kent was honored with the Wallace Stegner Award from the Center of the American West in April of 2012 and counts among his many other awards and accolades the 2002 Evil Companions Literary Award. He and his wife, Kathy, live in Salida. Benediction, published by Knopf, landed on our shelves last week and is already on its way to the top of the bestseller lists. It is the number one Indie Next pick for March, and believe me, there's a lot of competition to get into that position. And the Tattered Cover has designated it our very impressive book for March. Booksellers around the country have been biding their time and thrilled at last to put Benediction in the hands of readers. Simply put, to you and all the readers who walk through our doors, the only words I'll really need are the same ones I used for Plain Song and Eventide. Just trust me, it's brilliant. Please join me in welcoming Kent Harif.
Thank you very much, and I'm very glad you came out tonight. It's wonderful to see you. I want to especially thank Kathy Langer for that generous introduction. Kathy and I have known each other for quite a long time, and she's one of my favorite booksellers. Also here tonight are other Tattered Cover people, Margaret Maupin, I just saw her, and Virginia Valentine, and of course, Charles Stillwagon, who is the manager of this store here. So I'm very appreciative to all of them for inviting me here tonight. And as I say, I'm very glad you've come out. I want to also say again what Kathy has just said, that independent bookstores are so important to us and other people in this country. We've gone on quite a few book tours, and we've gone almost exclusively to independent bookstores by design. And we certainly want to, we are going to do a very limited book tour this year. I'm not in the best of health. So the number one store we were coming to was this one here. We knew that, 6 months ago, I think. And then we're doing a few others, but they're all independent bookstores. And that's something that we still want to support as much as we possibly can. When we went on tour, when Eventide came out in 2004, we went to 23 cities, and every one of those places we went to an independent store, except the one in Madison, Wisconsin, where they no longer had an independent store. So I'm glad you've come out tonight and support stores like this one. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be anywhere. But it's especially satisfying to be among people who read books. What I want to do tonight is to talk a little bit about how this book came to be, how I came to write it, and then to read a very brief passage of this book, and then to open it up for questions, and hopefully you'll have some comments or questions to ask. And I much prefer easy ones. So if you'll do that, please. I'm always a slow writer. I have been all along, and I've been writing for over 40 years now. But it seems to me I was especially slow this time. I had in mind to write a story about a young woman with a little girl in the back seat, and they were driving across eastern Colorado, and the car broke down. And so they had to hitchhike into the nearest town, which turned out to be Holt, Colorado. And the car could not be fixed, so they wandered around town a little bit and were befriended by an old couple out at the edge of town. And then it finally dawned on me that I'd already written that story. In many ways, that story is the story of Victoria Rubino in Plainsong. So then I got a brilliant idea, and I decided I would write a story about a young man and his little girl. They were driving across the eastern plains. And their car broke down, and they hitchhiked into town, and they were befriended by an old couple out at the edge of town. And then, finally, if you believe this, I realized that I'd already written that story, and all I'd done was change the sex of the main character. So then I began to think more about it, and it occurred to me that the people I was most interested in those two takes on the book, were the old couple out at the edge of town. And after I thought more and more about them, then I decided to name them and to invent a history for them and a family and all of that. And they, of course, turned out to be Dad Lewis and his wife, Mary. And then they had to have neighbors and family members and people they knew in the town and area. And so all of that thinking and all of that daydreaming and brooding led to this story of Benediction. Now, that may seem fairly easy to have come to, but it was not. It was a fairly torturous procedure. And as I say, it's taken me a long time. And in the middle of that, I had a couple of surgeries that delayed things. But that's the simplified version of the background of Benediction. During the entire writing of this book, my wife Kathy was absolutely instrumental and essential to my writing of the book. She was encouraging all along. That was very important to me. And she also did some of the mechanical things. She entered the book into the computer two or three times. I write on a manual typewriter. And so she took that manual typewriter script and put it in the computer. She also copy edited a fair amount of times and helped a great deal. So I'm very grateful to her. And as I say, it took me a long time, and the last effort at this. I started over in 2011, completely rewrote the book, and then the final pass, as they call it, came to me at the time I was in the hospital, and I finished the last effort at the copy editor's effort while I was in the hospital bed. So it had a long journey to get to this point. So that's maybe enough about the writing of the book. I do want to say one thing more. I see a lot of people I recognize here tonight. I'm very glad you've come out. But if you come up to have a book sign and I don't remember your name, please do not be offended. I'll give you an example of that. Some years ago, I was giving a reading and signing books afterward, and a man came up to the table to have a book sign, and I knew exactly who he was. He was one of my uncles. And but I could not remember his name for anything. So finally, in desperation, I said, "Well, how do you spell your name?" And he said, "B-O-B." So then I wanted to be a smartass and say, "Well, is that with a capital B or is it two O's? Or how do you spell that?" In any case, please don't be offended if I don't know your name immediately. And it's partly to do with age and partly to do with the state of my mind. But I say again, I'm glad you've come. So what I want to read tonight, then, is the first chapter of Benediction. It's quite short, and it goes like this. When the test came back, the nurse called them into the examination room, and when the doctor entered the room, he just looked at them and asked them to sit down. They could tell by the look on his face where matters stood. "Go on ahead," Dad Lewis said. "Say it." "I'm afraid I don't have very good news for you," the doctor said. When they went back downstairs to the parking lot, it was late in the afternoon. "You drive," Dad said. "I don't want to." "Are you feeling so bad, honey?" "No, I don't feel that much worse. I just want to look out at this country. I won't be coming out here again." "I don't mind driving for you," she said. "And we can come this way again anytime you want to." They drove out from Denver, away from the mountains, back onto the high plains. Sagebrush and soapweed and brugrama and buffalo grass in the pastures, wheat and corn in the planted fields. On both sides of the highway were the gravel county roads going out away under the pure blue sky. All the roads straight as the lines ruled in a book, with only a few small, isolated towns spread out against the flat, open country. It was sundown when they got home. By then, the air was starting to cool off. She parked the car in front of their house at the west edge of Holt on the gravel street, and Dad got out and stood looking for a while. The old white house, built in 1904, the first on the street, which wasn't even much of a street then, and still only three or four houses there yet when he bought it in 1948, the year he and Mary were married. He was 22, working at the hardware store on Main Street. Then the old lame man who owned it made up his mind to move away to live with his daughter, and he offered Dad the option of purchasing it. And he was a known man in town by then. The bankers knew him and gave him the loan without question. So he was the proprietor of the local hardware store. It was a frame house, sided with clapboard, two-story with a red shingled roof, with an old-fashioned black wrought iron fence around it and an iron gate with spears and hard loops at the top. Out back was an old red barn and a pole corral grown over with tall weeds. And beyond that, there was nothing but the open country. He went inside to the downstairs bedroom to put on old pants and a sweater and came back out and sat down in one of the porch chairs. She came out to find him. "Do you want supper now? I can make you a sandwich." "No," he said, "I don't want anything. Maybe if you could bring me a beer." "You don't want anything to eat?" "You go on ahead without me," he said. "Do you want a glass?" "No." She went inside, excuse me. She went inside and returned with a cold bottle. "Thank you," he said. She went back in. He drank from the bottle and sat looking out at the quiet, empty street in the summer evening. The neighbor, Berta May's yellow house next door, and the other houses beyond it, running up to the highway, and the vacant lot directly across the street, and the railroad tracks 3 blocks in the other direction. All of that part of town still empty and undeveloped between his property and the tracks. In the trees in front of the house, the leaves are blowing a little. She brought a tray of crackers and cheese and an apple cut up in quarters and a glass of iced tea. "Would you like any of this?" she said. She held out the tray to him. He took a piece of apple, and she sat down beside him in the other porch chair. "Well, that's it," he said. "That's the deal now, isn't it?" "You might be wrong," she said. "They're wrong sometimes. They can't be so sure." "I don't want to let myself think that way," he said. "I can feel it in me that they're right. I don't have much time left." "Oh, I don't want to believe that," she said. "Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that's how it's going to be." "I don't want you to go yet," she said. She reached across and took his hand. "I don't." There were tears in her eyes. "I'm not ready." "I know. We better call Lorraine pretty soon," he said. "I'll call her," she said. "Tell her she doesn't have to come home yet. Give her some time." He looked at the beer bottle and held it in front of him and took a small drink. "I might get me some kind of better grade of beer before I go," he said. "A guy I was talking to said something about Belgian beer. Maybe I'll try some of that, if I can get it around here." He sat and drank the beer and held his wife's hand, sitting out on the front porch. So the truth was, he was dying. That's what they were saying. He would be dead before the end of summer. By the beginning of September, the dirt would be piled over him, over what was left of him, out of the cemetery 3 miles east of town. Someone would cut his name into the face of a tombstone, and it would be as if he never was. And that's the end of that first chapter. Thank you. Now, if you're willing and obliging, maybe we'll have a little conversation between us. If you have some questions or comments to make. Yes, ma'am, go ahead. I do remember you as soon as I see you stand up.
Yeah, I was one of your students, and I brought my dad this time, Dale.
Oh.
He's right here.
No, good to see you.
Kara Van Horn. I was just wondering if you had a house in mind out there.
On the street?
Yeah,
the question is, do I have a house in mind on that street? No, I don't really. It's a house that I've invented and moved the rooms around the way I wanted them and faced it the direction I wanted it to. And I certainly wanted it at the edge, the west edge, that's not insignificant, on the edge of town, and to have prairie just beyond that so that the back end of it looks out at open country. And for my own peculiar taste, I wanted the streets still to be graveled. That, to me, has a different feel and a different suggestiveness than the paved street does. And so all of those things were a part of my thinking in regard to the house itself and where it's located. And also the wrought iron fence around it, I would say, is not insignificant. So I had that in mind from the beginning. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yes, sir. Are there any of the same characters in this book that there were in Plain Song, in Eventide? No, not really. These are all, this is all a new set of characters. There is a slight reference in a couple of places to people in Plain Song, one out in the country and one at a restaurant. And I did that for my own private satisfaction of referring to them. Yeah, but essentially, no, there are not. In the first 3 books, I think the only character that was repeated was the sheriff. And people kept doing bad things, and the sheriff had to come into the story. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Is there anything significant about the summer he dies at?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yes, I wanted it to be in sweltering weather. That seemed to me more important and more significant for this particular story. And as you'll discover later on, there are a few scenes that are set in the past, and all of those scenes are set in the winter. So it should be a cue to the reader immediately, even though I don't put them in italics or anything like that, that because they're set in the winter, the reader should recognize that this is an attempt on my part to cast backward for a little ways. So, yeah, summer was a part of that. Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Colorado to really get this whole feeling. So.
Have I spent a lot of time in Eastern Colorado? Yeah, yes, that's a good question. I grew up there. We lived out in Eastern Colorado until I was 10, I think. And then I later taught school out there for about 8 years. So it's a part of the world that I think I know best. Certainly it's the part of the world that I have the most, the deepest emotional response to. I don't live there anymore, but it certainly has been an effect on me. And it suits my purposes to set all my stories there. And I think any story I write in the future will probably be set there. It seems to me there's plenty to write about in regard to that place, but it's not just that place anymore. I think when I first began to write, I had the grandiose ambition to put northeastern Colorado on the literary map, and I don't think about that so much anymore, but I do want to set my stories out there because things are isolated on the plains, it seems to me, and you can see forever, and you can see. And so you can't really, in essential terms, you cannot hide out there. And it's like shining a spotlight on people and places out there. And that appeals to me as someone who's trying to write the kind of books that I'm writing. So that suits me. And you know, I mean, we all know that eastern Colorado is that part of the state that people drive across as fast as they can to get to Denver and Boulder and Estes Park and so on. But if you grew up there, that's how the world is supposed to look. It's supposed to be flat and treeless and sandy, and there's no excuse for all these trees back here. You know? So that's sort of how I feel about that. But if you've grown up there and you love it, it seems to me that there's so much to see there. I usually say about it that it's not beautiful. Excuse me, it's not pretty, but it's beautiful if you know how to look at it.
But you can actually love it without having grown up.
You can, yes, ma'am. You certainly can, right. I have had people, though, who have come out from New York and driven on those state highways out there and been frightened by the lack of traffic. And that strikes me as odd, but it could be that way. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah, Kathy.
You write so beautifully about dying, about the process of dying and the end of Dad's days, and if you could talk a little bit about sort of what you know about that process. Kathy was involved with hospice, yeah. and it just honored the process so much.
Thank you. If you hear the question, it has to do with what's been my experience about death and dying, and as you suggest, my wife Kathy has been involved in hospice for a long time now, and I was involved for a short while as a volunteer. So we did see people dying, and we did try to help them and take care of them and so on and bathe them and all of that. And most hospice volunteers would say, and I certainly say, that it was absolute privilege to be with people in that condition. You're in a kind of honored place when you're a hospice volunteer or when somebody is dying. And it's a privilege to be there. It's an honor to be there. And often it's quite sad, but it's also extremely touching to be to see families in that condition and how they respond to the death of someone they love and how they take care of the body and all of that. And it's a sacred time, I think. And I certainly felt that way. And And I want to convey that in this book if I can, and maybe I've done it, I don't know. But I certainly intended to and wanted to. Yeah. Yes?
Marilynne Robinson in Gilead addresses that subject, you know, someone, an older person dying.
Yes.
Starts out with that too. And just to follow up on what she said, I mean, that could be a very sentimental and emotional thing, but you portray it, it seems, in a very matter of fact way. And I think also in Gilead, brings about all of this family history
mm-hmm.
and the relationships.
Yes, that was at least in part my intention. The question had to do with, I don't know, the relevance of Marilynne Robinson's book and how I was trying to do somewhat a similar thing. I certainly did not want to sentimentalize this and make it maudlin or melodramatic. I wanted the opposite. And it suggests a kind of dignity about that. But also the possibility of regret and remorse and those feelings in this particular book, I don't want to give it away, but they're not exactly answered. They're not satisfying. And so it was an attempt on my part to convey not only the physical properties of death, but also to suggest some of the emotional responses to it, and among people, the man who's dying, but the people around him. And the other part of that seemed to me, in terms of writing those scenes, there's a kind of a very careful balance you have to make between giving enough detail so that it's vivid and compelling, but not giving so many details that it becomes tedious and unbearable in terms of the tediousness. And so I know when I was writing those scenes, I had to go back and cut a fair amount out because it began to seem too long and too cumbersome. Yeah. Yes?
The water tank scene was among my favorites, and I really appreciated the way you portrayed the community of women and the support that women gave, which I think is no small feat for a male author. I really appreciated that. It resonated, it rang true, and perhaps you would want to share some of your female sources.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give that scene away for people who have not read it yet, but there is a scene in which women are exclusively together. And it's a scene that I hope has some joy and some exuberance in it, and maybe without claiming too much for it, I want to think of it as a kind of a ritualistic moment in the book. And I don't know, somebody asked me once if I thought women were better at communicating with one another than men are with one another. And I think they are. And I would love to have had more opportunities to be the fly on the wall and listen to women talk. But yes, that's an attempt on my part to try to convey some of my affection and admiration for women. Yeah. And the way they form circles or kind of a bond with one another. I thought, and yes, go ahead, please.
Can you comment on your choice of point of view in this, how you leverage it to create the level of intimacy that you experience?
Okay, thanks for that. The question is how I manage point of view and hopefully create something that seems intimate. Of course, this book and the last two have been written in third person. And the advantage of that is that you're not limited to what a first-person narrator knows and can know. But in third person, you know, you're free to go anywhere and to be anywhere. But I've made my own decision to limit the range of what a third-person narrator can do. I don't think I ever or if I do hardly ever, go into the minds of these people in terms of revealing their thoughts. My attempt is to reveal their thoughts by what they say and by what they do, and I want to believe that the reader will care about these people with those limitations. I've gotten suspicious, I guess, of authors availing themselves of the ability to go inside people's minds and explain what they're thinking. I don't ever want to explain to you what the meaning of a story or meaning of a scene is. I want you to enter into the effort of this, of creating this story yourselves, and to figure that out yourselves. So I've avoided that. I don't know if it's a crush, but that position anyway. And in third person, I mean, obviously the narration has to be standard edited American English. And the dialogue should be colloquial. It should be casual and an attempt to convey the way people speak. Dialogue, of course, is not a tape recording of human speech. If you don't believe that, look at the Watergate tapes. They're nearly unintelligible. But what you're trying to do is to say something in dialogue which sounds like natural speech. So all of that is part of third-person narration. Of course, it can be a part of first-person, too. But those are some of the things I was thinking about. And dialogue in this book is certainly all in present tense, and the narration is all in past tense. And so that's a standard way of dealing with it. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I must admit this is the first of your books I've ever read, and I dearly love the honesty that comes through in it. I was just wondering if on your book tours for other books that in Holt, you've had folks from other parts of the country come up to you and say, who could be the town I grew up in Georgia, or
yeah,
the town I grew up in Minnesota, or something like that?
Yeah, thank you for that comment, and I have had that experience, and San Francisco and Georgia and other places. Yeah, and I'm pleased about that. The question has to do with, I'm sorry, I should have repeated it, whether people in other parts of the world besides eastern Colorado have felt a kinship with those people and with what happens there. It's my hope that what happens to people in Holt, Colorado is not dissimilar from what happens to people in Denver and Salt Lake and Texas and other places. I want to believe that, as in the case of Plainsong, that pregnant teenage girls are everywhere in this country and that they need help, and there are lonely old women dying up over Main Street all over this country, and lonely old men who need expanded lives. And in this case, there are certainly old men who are dying all over the country, all over the world, and who are being taken care of by their families. And so those conditions, those elements, I want to believe are universal. And it just, as I've said before, it suits my purposes to set these stories out on the high plains of Colorado, partly because there are fewer complications in terms of city life or traffic or any of that kind of thing. But yeah, I do hope that. I don't want to claim too much for my stories, but that's my intent, yes. Yes, sir.
You're aware, I'm sure, that small towns and the real life counterparts to Holt in Colorado, Georgia, and Minnesota are not getting any bigger.
They're not what?
They're not getting any bigger.
No.
Their street and populations are getting older. And I wonder if that knowledge has informed your writing, especially the last 3 months.
The fact that they're getting smaller, whether that has, it has somewhat. But I'm not, on the other hand, I'm not trying to write sociology. Instead, I'm trying to write fiction about the human condition and trying to say something that might be believable about what happens to people and as we pass through our lives. There's a review coming out soon, and I'm quite annoyed by it. I've seen the preview of it, and I think it'll be out next Sunday. But in that review, the guy who reviewed the book believes that all novels set in small towns should be about the changes in small towns. And that's an annoyance to me, because I'm not trying to write that kind of story. I'm not at all. And it seems to me, it's very important to me to try to write a book, as I say, about the human condition and about individual people. And they can become the representative of all of us. And to answer your question, that's what I'm attempting to do. Yeah. Any, yes, go ahead.
So when you set out to write a book like yourself, do you go out looking for Alt Colorado? Are you trying to find something that...
Am I looking for Alt Colorado? And, well...
I mean, after I've read your books, I've been out looking for it.
Well, the only map is probably the one in my mind. I'm the sole proprietor of Alt Colorado. And... I think I know everybody in county and all the dogs and all of them. But as I suggested earlier, Holt County and Holt, Colorado are informed by my childhood and by my having taught out there for those years. And it's similar to some of those towns out there, but it's not identical. And what I've borrowed from a town out there is simply the names of streets and where the highway is and where the railroad tracks is, where Main Street is and how it goes north and south and all those things, which are very important to me. But Holt is not one of those towns. It's not the same. But it's similar to those towns out there. When I was a kid, I lived in Ray, Holyoke, and Newman. Those towns are all part of my thinking and feeling about Holt. How are we doing on time? We are one or two more questions in the back.
Would you talk a little bit about the Chekhov influence and exactly what Chekhov means to you?
You've all heard that question about Chekhov. Chekhov, you know, lived in from 1860 to 1904, I believe it is. And he's often described as the father of the modern short story, and also the father of the modern play. And in regard to his fiction, he's often said to be a master of writings in such a way that he makes tragedies out of trivialities. And so what I've attempted to do is to take the ordinary and to make it seem significant and important. So I've tried to learn that from Chekhov, but also in terms of his style, Chekhov is extremely spare in adjectives and adverbs and details. He taught himself how to choose those details that were absolutely essential to understanding the stories and how people looked and what the setting was. And he was never sentimental about anything. And he never solved the problems that he posed. He believed that he should not do that. And those kinds of things are things that I try to emulate. And he once wrote a letter, and it's quite a famous letter in literature. He wrote the letter to Gorky. And Gorky was known for having written voluminous books, but endless sentences with endless numbers of details. And he chastised Gorky for doing that and told him how when you have that many details, the reader cannot tell what is the important detail, which thing you're supposed to pay attention to. So the better writing is to write sparely and to be certain that the details you give are absolutely essential. And so again, I've tried to learn that from him. You know, for example, if you see somebody walking towards you, how soon, once you see that person, can you tell whether it's male or female? Well, quite a ways away, usually. And what else do you need to know to have that person set in your mind, at least the main details? I always think you have to know something about the hair color. You need to know something about the age, those kinds of things. If that person has a limp, that's noteworthy and you should mention that. I don't think we want to know something that's essential about somebody on page 300. I think you want to know that fairly soon up front. And so those kinds of principles are very important to me in terms of what I'm trying to do. But Chekhov was certainly the master at that. I think there's one more question. Oh, all right, right here. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What are you working on now?
What am I working on now? I'm working on trying to be available in my mind and spirit to the next story. And I haven't got one yet. I've got something slightly forming in the back of my mind, but it's not at all clear, and maybe it won't turn into be anything. But I'm in that sort of fallow period now where I'm disconcerted about what's going on. I feel most content in my life when I'm working on a long project like a novel, and where I know every day what I'm going to do when I get up and work on, even if I don't get a lot done that day. But now I'm done with this book, and I'm waiting for something else to occur to me. So I'm trying to pay attention to what I'm thinking about just before I go to sleep, and just as I'm waking up, that kind of twilight moment in our lives. And also if I'm taking a walk, I'm paying attention to any daydream that I'm having. Or if I'm driving a distance, I'm trying to do that same thing. So I'm trying to, I don't know what else to say except to be available to these kind of intimations of a new story that comes to me. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. Good to see you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.